This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
From Dinosaur Adventure World. It seems like you folks are waiting for Non Sequitur to start. Maybe if you wait long enough, it will actually evolve into a good show. I'm sorry, folks. Looks like I need some water. the Lord told me I needed to warn you folks that this podcast is full of crude humor, facts, and critical thinking. So if those things offend you like they do me, now is the time to close out this window. But if you think elephants and pine trees are related, then hit that subscribe button and click the bell so that you know every time this blasphemous channel goes live. Okay, I need to get out of here. You never know when Aaron is going to make an appearance. Hovind out.
Non Sequitur. Your facts are ignored. Non Sequitur. Your facts.
Hey, thanks, Kent, for that lovely opening. You know, Kent loves our channel so much. He was thrilled to death to do that little, a monologue, soliloquy? I don't know. That little promo for us. So thank you, Kent, for that. That was awesome. Actually, the voiceover for that is someone we actually have in tonight's discussion. But first of all, let me welcome you guys to Non Sequitur Show. Kyle is out tonight. He has other plans, but we have a great show for you tonight. We've got a lot of people coming in to have a discussion on the Bible and theology and maybe some cosmological arguments. I'm going to just kind of turn it over to them and let them kind of jump in and introduce themselves. But let me kind of give you a brief overview of who we got in here. We've got a new person. He's kind of new to us. He's been around the community. He's been on SJ Channel. His name is Daniel Ray. He's an apologist. He wrote a book called The Story of the Cosmos, How the Heavens Declare the Glory of God. And we also got back with us Skylar Fiction. We got Dr. Josh Rowan, and we have Wayne Fillmore. So we got a good group tonight. So how about we let the newer person kind of introduce themselves first, and then you regulars can kind of have at it. So Daniel, by the way, welcome. Nice to meet you. I have seen you around, Steve. But I don't think we've ever actually had communications before. So
yeah, we have exchanged chirps on Twitter, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think exactly.
We've chirped at each other. But thank you for, I saw the invite on Twitter today, so I thought I would take a shot with that. But I am Daniel Ray. I am, as Steve said, I've co-edited and co-contributed to an anthology on the cosmos written from a Christian perspective. Each chapter is an individual voice of a contributor in their field. We have literary experts. We have cosmological experts, Dr. Luke Barnes. We have William Lane Craig giving a chapter on creation ex nihilo. And it's a wonderful, we have the Vatican astronomer, Brother Guy Consolmagno, is contributing a chapter. It's a wonderful compendium of individual chapters about the cosmos from a Christian perspective. that incorporates the latest scientific discoveries about fine-tuning exoplanets, black holes. And we have, some of you may know, maybe you, I think you know, Steve, a lot of you know Sarah Salviander, perhaps, from Twitter.
Of course.
She is an astrophysicist. She's in our book. So I met Sarah on Twitter. And I'm normally a middle school teacher, and I would consider myself a lay astronomer and a lay theologian. I'm not specially trained in the sciences or specially trained in theology, but I've been a Christian for about 25 years.
Awesome. All right. How about you, Wayne? Welcome back. You've been on numerous times. People should know who you are by now, but just in case they don't, Wayne, introduce yourself.
Hey, what's up, guys? Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay. So I'm Wayne. Nice to meet you guys. Also known as a science enthusiast. You can go and follow my channel at Science Enthusiast on YouTube. Former younger creationist, evolution of creationist. Former PR guy for the Great Debate Community. Got Hugh Rawls. Who else did we get on here? Fuzz Ryan, all those good guys on here. I'm just a guy who wants to be an honest Christian, and I don't like pseudoscience. So, yeah. And I'm done.
Yeah, that is true. You you were an amazing PR guy, and you were the one who facilitated the initial conversations with Dr. Ross way back when. Yes, that is true. Next, we got Dr. Josh Bowen, fan favorite to the Non Sequitur Show.
How you guys doing?
And by the way, let's give it away. Who did the voice for
Doctor? Well, I'm not sure, but I've been teaching high school science for the last 15 years, and if you believe that pine cones and dogs are related, well, that's fine. But that's not science. That's religion.
That's too good.
It's amazing. Too good. Every time it's great. It gets better and better.
I feel like my IQ drops though every time I do it. So
you actually have to dumb yourself down to do that voice.
Well, I appreciate anyways, you guys
what about your
me
channel? Digital Hammurabi.
Dr. Joshua Bowen from Digital Hammurabi. My wife Megan and I run what I consider to be the coolest channel ever. There's stiff competition around here. So, but we do the ancient Near East in general. So I have a PhD in Assyriology from Johns Hopkins University. My wife is very close. She's hoping to finish hers up this year, also in Assyriology. I worked in slightly older periods, so third millennium, early second millennium, sort of when I focused on. I focused on Sumerian and Akkadian linguistics. But I have a master's in theology from Capital Bible Seminary, where I focused on Old Testament studies. So I took a lot of Hebrew, took an awful lot of Aramaic. Yeah, so our channel is essentially designed to make the ancient Near East palatable to regular people. So, yeah, I'm excited to be here.
And how do you say Wata?
It's the water and the otter.
Water and the otter. See, I can't do it. I have no voiceover abilities. And last but not least, Skylar Fiction from the Skylar Fiction Show or channel or whatever he named it this week.
You know what? It's the Skylar Fiction Show. What's up, everybody? Man, I'm super excited to be here. Every time I come on the Non Sequitur Show, it's always fantastic, except for the Mr. Intelligent episode. That was a little rough. But every other time has been absolutely amazing. It's been absolutely amazing. Well, if you don't know me, like I said, I run the Skylar Fiction Show. You just go to YouTube, type Skylar Fiction with an AR. I host Christians regularly on for discussions, debates. And it's been doing it for a couple of years now. It's been really, really fun. Dr. Josh Bowen, my hero, my confidant, has been very, very generous with his time. And we've grown like a very good friendship. And he is pretty much, well, not pretty much, he has become my co-host on the Skylar Fiction Show. And it's been an amazing experience. But if you like theology talks, you like debates, good conversations, I sometimes will admit that I get some really interesting characters on my show. Sometimes they could be more intellectual. Sometimes it could be kind of a dumpster fire. It just depends on how you look at it. But that's it. Skylar Fiction Show. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it if you enjoy this show.
You've had some pretty infuriating conversations, to be straight up. I mean, some of them have been newsworthy. I mean, literally, you've been in the news with a couple of your discussions you've had with people. They've been so awful.
We've gotten, I almost had my channel banned because of Matt Powell. He decided to talk about some really dark things executing people. Yeah, very, very dark. And that YouTube tried to flag my channel for hate speech, or me promoting hate speech, which was absolutely ridiculous. I was arguing against his opinions and his ideas. But, you know, it went really well for me. Richard Dawkins ended up sharing out my channel, getting me a lot of media attention. And, you know, overall, I got my channel back, worked out, and the video never got demonetized, which is the funniest thing, even though it was considered
He got a strike, but he didn't even get demonetized. There you go. So tell us real quick before we jump into the whole discussion. You two have started a new channel. It's called Digital Fiction, I believe. You got a few videos out. Do you guys want to like promote that for a few minutes real quick?
Yeah, let's just – Dr. Josh, is it okay if I talk about it real quick? Do you want to say anything? Yeah. Or?
You're the eloquent one, my friend.
Please. So one of the things, Dr. Josh and I, you know, like I said, he had been coming on my channel for a while. And he's been so helpful, you know, and, you know, having someone who has so much knowledge about the ancient Sumeria. And, you know, what Josh didn't tell you in his introduction, he was a minister, I believe, for 10 years, I believe has a PhD or a bachelor's in divinity or a PhD in divinity.
I have a master's in theology and
a PhD. I have none of those. But I can talk really well. So it works out for us. So the thing was, you know, we wanted kind of to do something together. You know, we still have we're still going to be doing the Skylar Fiction Show and Digital Hammurabi, but we wanted to kind of have a new creative outlet to kind of do some funner things, some new kind of concepts. Of course, we're going to try to do 2-on-2 debates. We have a fun idea, and this is where we really need, you know, the audience help. We'd like to kind of host people of, Christians, people of different faiths, to do what we want to call the digital fiction court, or Dr. Josh's court, where we will hold like maybe two people who have different ideas about the Bible. Maybe someone believes in the Trinity, someone doesn't, someone's a Calvinist, someone's an Arminian, right? And Dr. Josh will be the judge, and the two Christians will make their arguments. And Skylar Fiction here will be the lawyer for both sides, calling out BS arguments and flawed logic. So we want to do things like that. We want to talk about more concept of living in a secular world, how to teach your children about difficult concepts like God. You know, it could be a difficult thing when most of society is a particular religion and you're not teaching your children that religion. So we want to talk about how you raise children. Both Dr. Josh and I have kids. And we want to kind of have deeper discussions about secularism. And many other topics. And of course, you know, we're going to bring that same old entertainment, fun, and laughter that we always do on the Skylar Fiction Show. So that's a basic gist of it. Check it out. I think later on we'll probably have links to these in the description. And we hope you come over and check it out and watch.
And we've got an intro video. I don't know if I got it to Dave in time. But if... I don't know if you're
Did you get the asset for a video?
Yeah.
Okay. So somebody said in the live chat, basically a summation is Josh is the brain, Skylar's the mouth. Together, they are digital fiction.
That's probably a good
synergistic relationship.
You know, we like the journey, man, and we have a lot of fun, and we do Bible studies too, which is really fun. We're going to do Bible studies on there, you know, because it isn't just for Christians. It's for atheists too. If atheists are going to argue against the Bible and argue against Christians, they should know what's in it. And they should know the context of what's going on, because we don't want people making poor and terrible arguments. If you make good arguments, you can convince people, and bring them over to your side and free people from what I call a very dangerous religion.
Well, you know why Dave is trying to find that video. Dave, did you find it? Okay, go ahead. Let's do the video first, and then we'll jump in with that. If the Bible holy or unholy.
Hey,
You know, I got to say, Dr. Bowen looks really good with a mullet. I mean, especially if you're like back in the 90s, but I'm telling you, I dig that style. I had a mullet back in the 90s, so I think you should try it out, man. Let it all grow.
I feel like anyways, I have already the John Travolta, like, confused look, you know, so.
Yeah, you do it. You can pull it off perfectly, you know. But so let's kind of get into the topic here. Scott, do you want to, like, maybe give your main criticisms of the Bible or maybe address Daniel with why you think that the Bible is not what it purports to be, and he can maybe give you an apologetic answer, and then we can kind of have a discussion from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I would say if someone, and I know because Christians around the world have very different views. You have more moderate positions. You have people who are Bible believing Christians who believe every word of it, take it very, very literal. What I would say is the biggest problem with Christianity is the actual Bible and the way that it describes God. A couple of the main issues that I personally have is I believe that the God of the Bible is very morally contradictory. He's all over the place with how he treats human beings. The way that he is described as kind, loving, gentle, doesn't play out, especially in the Old Testament. I mean, you can make arguments with the New Testament. I definitely like Jesus a lot better than I like the God of the Old Testament. But when you really look at what's going on, you know, he says he loves human beings, but then constantly he does terrible things to them, does terrible things to little ones. I would say the other big thing that I think there's a huge problem with is the overly complicated solution that God builds for a problem that basically he made. For instance, we need Jesus Christ, God, to come back into the flesh and to die on a cross in order to forgive a sinful nature that he allowed to be passed on from Adam and Eve. God could have solved pretty much every problem that human beings had in the very, very beginning. But he chose this overly complicated system that's really kind of useless and constantly and consistently goes against his own goals. Right, like depending on who you look at, all that. Let's say once again, now a Christian could have a very more poetic look at the Bible, where they don't take it so literally, and maybe some of these problems aren't so strong. But I think generally, you know, the fact that he made human beings to be able with the ability to pass on a sinful nature from Adam and Eve through federal headship, and now because of that disease, sickness, suffering comes in the world, and now we are required to have a savior. And the way we learn about that savior is through a complicated book that's passed down through thousands of years, written in many languages and translated. It seems like it's going against his goal and way too complicated for a all-powerful being that if the ultimate goal is just to have a relationship with us, he makes it surely very, very complicated. I think that's a good starting point. Someone's mic is rubbing. Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead, Daniel.
Okay. What was your name? Is Skylar your name? Is that
Skylar? Yeah.
Skylar. Okay. Hi, Skylar. We've never met. And so this is really sort of my first, well, not my first, but I don't do a lot of these on things. This would be my second one that I've done. I've done some in-person debates with David Smalley, and I've been on Atheist Edge with Jim, and so this is kind of weird for me not knowing y'all. So I like to be there in person, but I know sometimes you can't do this. But so I speak from my own experience. I've been a Christian for 25 years, and I understand, first of all, Skylar, that it takes work to understand the Bible. There's no question about that. And I think, you know, when I wasn't raised in church or anything like that. And I was baptized and believed that Jesus was the Christ before I had turned a page of scripture. And it took me the better part of a year or more to actually read through the Bible. And then 2 or 3 years after I was a Christian, really started to really, I think for the first time, really start to begin to understand what the Bible says. So I would affirm that it is a lifetime and a process to understand scripture, and it's not easy. So I would affirm that. And I think too, though, that there is, I mean, you articulated the gospel message fairly well. And I would say that a wide swath of what we would call Orthodox Christianity in the West would concur with the basic facts about who Jesus was. You know, if we go with John's gospel, it ties the beginning of everything back to Genesis. Most people could give you an articulate summation of the Christian story. So I think there is to learn and to know. I mean, behind the cross is Leviticus and Deuteronomy and burnt offerings and all of that. And it's certainly something I think a lot of evangelicalism, at least I was for a long time, very ignorant of. How did the law inform what Jesus does when he's walking along the road to Emmaus with his disciples in Luke 24, explaining to them the things that had to be fulfilled in relation to who he was, going all the way back to Moses and the prophets, as Luke records. So there's, you know, the walk to Emmaus was 7 to 10 miles. It took a couple of hours. What an exegetical story you got from the creator of the universe there. So even his own disciples that spent time with him in the flesh didn't understand it. They didn't even recognize Jesus as having resurrected. And it's kind of humorous how Luke records. They are saying, "Aren't you the only one in Jerusalem who is unaware of these things?" You know, and Jesus humorously, I think, would say, "What things?" And they're explaining to him as though Jesus didn't know what they were talking about. And I find that is oftentimes myself. I'm on some kind of Emmaus road and I'm going, "Lord, I don't understand this." So I think the understanding part is critical, and it's critical that we think clearly through that. And I think that I've done that over the years. That's sort of my background. I don't want to ramble on for 10 more minutes about everything else we could. I don't know how long you want to talk without letting somebody else talk. So I'll kind of pause there if you want and come back to something.
Skylar, I think what Skylar's asking is, and Skylar, I've listened to your narrative. You're basically running the argument that the original Old Testament kind of just depicts this immoral type being, as opposed or dunks a position against the New Testament, which Jesus seems to be a completely different entity, right? I think that's what he's wanting you to address, that kind of concept. Okay. Is that correct,
Skylar? Okay. His mic is on.
Oh, you're muted,
Skylar. I can't.
Yeah, your mic's off.
Sorry. Let me just make something real practical, right?
Sure.
I'll just ask you a simple question just so we can set up and make sure we don't disagree on what the book is saying, right?
Sure.
Do you agree with federal headship that a sinful nature was passed on from Adam and Eve onto their children and the rest of humankind?
Nature is a weird word, but something about sin was, you want to say, hereditarily passed along, whether it's some kind of substance or some kind of yes, but through Adam, all have sinned. Yes.
Yeah. And because of that, we now need a savior, which was Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. Correct.
So, and because of that, we don't have cult nature, whatever, sin coming into the world, now disease, suffering, everything horrible that we could possibly imagine is here because of that.
There are, I've often had good discussions with people about how the far-reaching effects of sin. What did Adam's fall accomplish cosmologically? How far into the animal kingdom? What did it do to the world? We have a brief description in Genesis of thorns and thistles and the sweat of the brow and birth pangs. How far out, though, did Adam's fall, you know, impinge upon the greater universe? I don't know. I don't know if the stars and the planets and things would be different, but I do agree that the sin nature did wreak havoc, at least on our terrestrial existence, to great and various degrees. Yes.
So the reason that it exists in the form that it is because God created a system in which it would. God couldn't have created another system in which this sin and suffering would not have come into world because of the disobedience of Adam and Eve. If they truly had free will. Please go ahead.
No, go finish. Go ahead, Scott.
No. What I would say is that God could have stopped this in the very, very beginning. Like, he literally could have just went, sin is done. Sin is forgiven. But the alternative, what he did, as explained in the Bible, is we had to go through all the Levitical laws. We had to go through tons of things I would view as immoral. And I think most human beings would view as immoral, that God condones and allows. We had to get all the way thousands of years to where Jesus dies on a cross in order to atone for sin that God could have fixed right in the beginning. So all this human suffering is because of a system that God set up. And what I'm basically getting at is that the idea is it's strange to argue that God loves us as human beings and wants a relationship with us and genuinely cares about us, while at the same time is the cause of all of this suffering.
I completely understand your point, and I think suffering and evil is probably the greatest enigma and problem, if you will, for the argument for a good and loving and divine being. So just briefly, Skylar, without I just want to be brief. I'm not trying to dodge your arguments or anything. But so you're familiar with the logical, the different various shades of the problem of evil. Of course, Alan Plantinga and believes that the logical problem of that has been at least solved. But it doesn't satiate the emotive or the more personal aspects of what suffering can be. There may be a logical reason why God allows this, but that doesn't seem to be an emotionally satisfying answer. And so I think there are two things working there. For me personally, Skylar, what I would say, because of suffering in my own life, in my own family, is that the system that was set up, and I agree with you, is God being God, he could have done something differently. I think for me, where I go with it, where I lean on, is that God set it up in such a way that he himself came into our terrestrial suffering in the flesh and experienced everything that we do as human beings through his suffering. And so if you look at, just to distill it down to a bullet point or so, if you look at all the Old Testament wrath and judgment that Yahweh enacted on people and nations, that was concentrated on Jesus in Calvary. So Yahweh takes on flesh, becomes the Son of Man for us, and all of the Old Testament wrath and judgment is poured out on Calvary, and that's why Jesus proclaims that it is finished. And so for me, I have to kind of leave it at the aspect of suffering and say, absolutely, I do not know, like Job. I've defended the book of Job several times on Atheist Podcast before. It's one of my favorite books because it's kind of my life. And so I love that narrative. I love the ancientness of it. And I think that with Job, I would say you have a pre-incarnate sort of suffering in Job, that the Job's sufferings become the sufferings of the Messiah servant of Isaiah, the man of sorrows. And so God sets it up so he enters into our sufferings with us.
I would say, to respond to that, is that I think a couple things are factually incorrect there. I would say that Jesus doesn't nearly go through the suffering of all human beings. In fact, when you really read the story of the New Testament, basically he's crucified and he's beaten. That compares almost nothing to what a lot of human beings have gone through and the suffering that human beings have gone through, and is once again unnecessary. The problem, I mean, God chose a methodology in which that was how he chose to atone for sin. In the Old Testament, he used blood sacrifice. He would kill animals, have human beings kill animals. He would do kind of quirky things like, you know, make people mutilate their own genitalia. It's the way God is described in the Bible is the way that human beings describe gods. And once again, the main crutch of what I was arguing earlier, he can solve this problem. He doesn't have to wait and have all this suffering. None of it's necessary. And the best argument that I've heard, and I'm not saying you're making this argument, but what I've said, that the only argument I've ever heard a Christian basically make is he has moral and sufficient reasons for doing the things that he does. And that's just basically the ends justify the means. And when you have a God with unlimited capabilities, unlimited powers, and the methodology he chooses is so violent, so oppressive to women in the Old Testament, so harmful to children, and I'm not talking about just some of the stuff he told people to do to children in the Old Testament. I'm talking about just disease and suffering in this world. The most innocent among us, God chooses to harm. So all because he chose this particular narrative that was completely unnecessary. And this is what I was getting the whole crutch of it. It's not to, and the reason I go to darker things, and I'm not doing it to make a Christian look bad or feel bad or anything like that. I just, it's just right to the point. It clears things up. And there's no real excuse for it, in my opinion. But
well, you know, Scott,
God created an overcomplicated. I guess what I'm saying. I'll summarize real quick. I apologize. God creates an overcomplicated system for something that he could just simply go, problem solved. It just doesn't. It doesn't logically or rationally make sense. And he's going against his own goals, which supposedly is to have a relationship with us. Go ahead, my friend.
I did an exegetical paper in graduate school on Jacob wrestling with the angel, and I had to identify what I believed about the being who comes to Jacob at night at Jabbok's Ford. It's Genesis 32. And it's an all-night wrestling match, and that's the text in which Jacob has his name changed from Jacob to Israel. And are you familiar, Scott? I don't know if it was Dr. Bowen or you. Are you both familiar with Hebrew? I mean, I know Dr. Bowen is. Are you
Dr. Bowen is. I'm not. Okay. He's the man to ask about this question. Yeah.
So, Dr. Bowen, you can correct me. I had a Hebrew professor grade this, but it's been a long time since I've actually gone back to the paper. But Israel, I remember writing this very specifically. The name Israel is Ish, man. Ra, which is a common Hebrew word for evil or struggle or strife, and El is the very common name in the ancient world for a generic name for God. And so you have man, struggle, God. And so for Jacob's name change, the angel who wrestles with him says, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have wrestled with man and God, and you have prevailed. And of course, Jacob walks away from that with a limp, with just a little, you know, a little hip touch or whatever that might have been. And I think Skylar, for me, that's the central story. Ish, Ra, El. And that El becomes an Ish and engages in our Ra. I know it may not seem sensical to our perception, but having just spent 4 years researching and writing for a book on cosmology, there's a lot in the physics of the universe that make absolutely no sense to current astronomical theories about how we know the universe. And it doesn't mean, I'm not saying the science is bad or positing God of the gaps there. I'm just saying that, and Roger Penrose in his most recent book, and Archibald Wheeler, who coined the term black hole, and these were brilliant. I mean, Penrose is brilliant. Mr. Wheeler was brilliant. John Archibald Wheeler, they both understood after decades of studying the fabric of space and time that the universe is just bizarre. And I think, to me, I really loved the resonation with cosmology and the weirdness of it. I likened a lot of what I saw in the stars and a lot of the star lore and a lot of the physics to the Israel, that God puts man in this world and lets him engage and raw and wrestle. And that's the fabric of this universe. We wrestle with it. We wrestle with ourselves. We wrestle with each other. And God came down to participate. And I don't, Skylar, ultimately, I don't know why he set it up that way. But that's what we have. And I am wrestling through that just like everybody else. And I don't have all the answers myself. I don't have the pat answers. But I think that is the epitome, I think, from Genesis to Revelation is Ish, Ra, El.
I think that's an honest answer, and I appreciate it, right? And I don't expect anybody to kind of have answers to those kind of tough moral questions.
No, they're very hard.
What I would just – they're very, very difficult. And I appreciate your candor and your honesty with it and your approach. What I would say is, and this is what I just try to get – and one of the reasons I do the channel – I do it with Dr. Josh, is that it's okay to believe in God, right? I'm never going to knock somebody for having some kind of God belief. I was a Christian for many, many years. I was doing an apprenticeship to be a minister at one point. When I left the Christian faith, I moved over to being more a typical deist. I'm just going to believe in a God creator, like some kind of creator God. I take a more traditionally now more agnostic position. I don't really have good arguments for deism, so I kind of figured I probably shouldn't support it. I think that I can understand someone, you know, looking like you were saying with the cosmos and the complexities of our universe, and there's a lot of things that we don't know and understand, right? Where I just find the danger with religion and Christianity is that it is Bible-based. because it makes us go against our reason and our own sanity. Like when, and the best that we can do, anybody, any Christian can really do, is just say, I don't understand God. I don't understand his methodology. And I think that it should be telling to us all that if we read verses from the Bible that make us uncomfortable, I'm not going to go through and list them in detail, but I mean, I think we all know the verses we're talking about. If we go through and read those verses and they make us feel uncomfortable, maybe it's just that human beings wrote this and it isn't actually from God. And if we want to believe that God's this loving, gentle being who cares about us, maybe the way that it's described in the Bible was more of a tool for leaders and kings to kind of hold against their people and used as a power tool to manipulate people. I don't know. I guess that's where I would leave. I feel like I've been talking so much. I don't want to.
I would like to jump in.
Go ahead.
If it's okay with you guys. Can you guys
hear me? Yeah, by all means. Yes.
So, Skyler, you asked some very, those are very good questions. Those are actually the type of questions people need to be asking. People need to ask those type of questions where they're either a hit or a miss. If I get the answer to this question, I'm going to leave this thing. And if, you know, the answer I get to this question is sufficient, then I'll stay in it. And I like what the guy said. I'll keep wrestling with it. But one of your questions in the beginning was something about Adam and Eve and federal leadership and all that stuff.
Yeah,
the sinful nature thing. So it's different for me because, as you know, I don't believe Adam and Eve even existed. I don't think they were historical figures at all. But I do think people still do have a sinful nature. I don't think our sinful nature comes from these two naked people running around some magic trees or something. Humans have a sinful nature just because we're human. As that saying goes, to err is to human. We sin, we do stupid stuff, we do bad stuff because we're just not perfect, because humans aren't, for whatever reason that may be. We sin because we're human. But also, you asked another good question too, as far as why did God even set it up that way? Why does sin even exist? Why did God even create this universe knowing that certain things would happen and blah, 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 blah. And I would say this is a question that I would think Yahweh, I would hope, had thought about all of this before he created the universe. It would be a bad thing for Yahweh to have created the universe and then he thinks about the question you asked and he's like, oh crap, how am I going to get around this? Because he's God, right? He should have already known this, right, from the beginning. So I picture it like before Yahweh creates the universe, he knows what's going to happen. He knows the outcome of everything that's going to happen in the universe. And with him knowing past, present, and future, no matter how you spin it, I don't want to be a Calvinist here. Do Calvinists believe God looks in time, or he? Because I know people are really like iffy about that. Like, does God look into time, or does God? I don't know. God looks into time, or he's already there. I don't want to get into the specifics of that, but he knows everything's gonna happen. And with that being the case, he knows. You know, if I make this decision, if I make it, let's say I make a universe and there's no dark matter, this is going to happen. Maybe the universe might implode on itself for some reason. If I make a universe and gravity is a little different, the universe is going to happen this way. And it may be that those same types of choices that God decided to make in the creation of the universe, it may be that God had to make those same type of moral choices where, let's say, God could have created a universe where maybe Hitler didn't exist. But let's say if Hitler didn't exist, let's say somebody five times worse than Hitler would have existed and would have completely wiped out the human race for some reason. And so God picks the lesser of the two evils to overcome or to get to the greater good, what you said, Skyler. And so that's how I picture it. There are things in this world that are horrible and terrible and messed up. But I leave it in God's hands because God's God and I'm not. And, you know, just as a Christian, I guess Christian would say by faith, we take it that God would use the lesser of the two evils.
I would think How I would respond to that is I would say that, and I feel bad, Dr. Josh Bowen, feel free if you would respond to these things.
Yeah, we're gonna get Dr. Bowen in a second.
Yeah, I feel bad. Because I can talk people's ears off. So here's the thing.
He's just here because he looks good, right? He's just all dressed up.
This is why I have him on the show. That's why he's on my show.
It's all his image, man. It's image.
And that wonderful Ken Hovind impression, which it wasn't a mistake, but we agreed on our last two episodes. We told people that if you did a super chat, he would read whatever it was in the Ken Hovind voice. And it was very successful, we'll say. But here's what I would say to you, Wayne. All right. There are all types of things that us as human beings don't have the capabilities of doing, right? I don't have the capability to grow wings out of my back and fly, right? That is a limitation that is on me that was decided in the very beginning. In the same way, this is a God of infinite possibilities, right? Like, this isn't some human being who's trying to solve, like, you know, moving pieces on a chessboard, trying to, you know, find the right positions and the best moves to win the game. Like, he could have just put us all in heaven right away. We could still have free will in heaven. Yeah,
I actually would disagree with that. I actually don't think God has like some sort of like this. I don't know, when people say stuff like that, it makes God sort of like magical. Like, I don't know, that's kid stuff. I think of that as kid stuff.
He can make universes. I mean, if he can make universes and make human beings and planets, I don't see why God can't make a planet where children don't get cancer, right? Like, it doesn't seem like there's a negative side to children not getting cancer. So, like, but within the world that he built, and like I said, sorry to be so extreme, but it just cuts right to the root of the problem here. And God can make a world where Nazism never showed up. Like, the concept of mass shootings in school could have never come up if that idea had never existed in the first place. So, like, there's an infinite amount of possibility. This is what I'm talking about. We limit God's capabilities in order to fit a narrative, because we want to believe in free will. We want to believe in all these things. We want to believe that God gives us a choice and things like that. But I think it's more just trying to justify particular beliefs that I just don't think are reasonable or logical. Please.
Let's get to Dr. Bowen, maybe, to kind of jump in real quick, Wayne, kind of get his feedback so far.
He's got nothing. I don't know that I've got a lot to add. I mean, I think these are, right, the general questions that come up time and again. I will very briefly just sort of talk about the Yisrael etymology. Generally speaking, I don't think that Israel is actually straightforward. There's a preterite form from the verb sadara, which means to fight, and ale at the end would be ale fights, or he fights with ale. I mean, I'm sure I haven't waded into the secondary literature on that, but I mean, those are, I think, pretty common derivations. It'd be difficult, I think, to get ra in there, because ra requires an ayin, and there's no ayin in there. Ish would start with Aleph, and there's just a yud that starts the word. But I mean, that was just what I was ruminating over a little bit. It's not really terribly important at the moment. But I guess, like, when I think about what Skylar and I talk about on the channel, and one of the reasons really that I got into doing YouTube at all, besides Steve telling Megan to tell me to do it, was
and she listened, and you listened.
She did. That's right. Well, I do what my wife tells me. So that's how that goes.
Smart man.
But, you know, the thing that I see so often is that, you know, I was a Christian for almost 30 years, pastored a church out in Virginia, which is an evangelical fundamentalist dispensational church. And, you know, so all of the things that everybody's saying here today, it's like a warm blanket, you know, going back over me. But I think that one of the things that I saw once I came out of this is that there tends to be this mindset that, unfortunately, until you're on the other side of it afterwards, and I say that afterwards because there are a lot of people that come out of atheism that go into Christianity. I think that there's something that takes place where you look back and there's something that clears, right? And there aren't confirmation biases that you're looking for. I mean, this is the case for me, right? This is somewhat anecdotal. But if anybody was entrenched in biblical Christianity, it was me. And I think that what was so key was going to Hopkins, having to engage with the ancient Near Eastern literature, the ancient Near Eastern historical contexts, and to see that this biblical text that I held up really almost as if it almost existed in a vacuum for all intents and purposes, and that it was unique in that sense, you know, divinely unique in that sense. It was something that sort of exploded, and I'm going to say much to my chagrin, but I mean, certainly kicking and screaming, it exploded. And I was kicking and screaming. That didn't make a lot of sense. Sorry. But I think now that I'm here in this, this YouTube community, and I'm seeing people debate these things and talk at length, and find what I consider to be plausible or possible explanations for difficult things, may not be the best way to go about this. And if we see particularly the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament texts, and those texts that kind of came up in the period that maybe we don't consider all canonical, if we see those as the product of people wrestling with and interacting with the divine in their culture, that really frees us up, I think, to see what is it that if there is a God, one God, or an actual God that is behind this text or these texts, what is the basic thread? What is the principle? What are the principles that we can see that sort of run through these texts? And how can we let then, or it allows us then to let what Schuyler is calling these grossly immoral characteristics of Yahweh, to sort of leave them in the context of the culture, and to say, this is people, these are people, and I think that's the point he was making, these are people writing as they would write, writing from their culture. And I think that, you know, my wife is a Christian, and I think this is the way that she is a Christian, right? Because she engages with the ancient Near Eastern texts and has no problem with them, because these are people interacting with what they consider to be the divine. And if we can let them speak as they would have spoken, as we would have expected them to have spoken in their cultural milieu, I feel like the problems dissipate. So thank you for letting me talk. I will go back to muting.
Well, let me ask you guys, because you kind of jumped over the point, and I was kind of curious about it. Briefly, you had touched on God creating, you know, what he possibly could create. Now, Leibniz has the phrase for that, the best of all possible worlds. Daniel had mentioned something about Plantinga coming up with a theodicy for the free will, his free will defense for the logical problem of evil, which I don't think accounts for things like natural evil. But the question I would prefer to you guys is, if God could possibly create any possible world, any scenario, and given that he would know the situations in each possible world, by the way, that seems to be incompatible with the free will defense, because the free will defense is actually an indeterminate position. It actually involves libertarian free will, which is incompatibilism. So it's not a deterministic position, which I find to be odd, because not many people hold to libertarianism. But why would you say that God had to create this possible world with every single natural or moral evil in it, as opposed to one single less evil, even if it was something that was so myopic that it wouldn't matter in the big picture? I mean, if one of the paradigmatic examples is that people stubbing their toes. If I stub my toe one less time, then that's one less natural evil in the world that doesn't change anything really, right? If I'm here to learn something, I'm not going to learn anything different whether I stub my own toe, you know, 50 times in life or 49 times in life. So what was the reasoning why God created this possible world out of all possible worlds?
I have kind of an anecdotal reply, Steve. So if we go to the late theologian, Dr. Stephen Hawking, I mean, he was a theologian. He concludes in this book, the first one they wrote, A Brief History of Time. The conclusion of the book says this: He says, however, if we do discover a complete theory, like a theory of everything in terms of physics, he says, it should be in time understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. And of course, Dr. Hawking died on Albert Einstein's birthday this past March, March 14th. So a little story about Dr. Hawking's passing. I was at the University of Texas in Dallas handing out flyers for an event that me and some friends of mine were putting together with a Hubble Space Telescope scientist. UTD's moniker is The Comet. And I was standing in the atrium near the library, and above me, about 14 feet on the pillars of the atrium, was a banner for a student service saying that we have been guiding comets. Comets is the UTD moniker. And on the banner, it was a student services for orientation. On the banner were constellations and star names. And at first, when I looked at the banner, I thought, wow, some astronomy club or something. But it was really just a student service organization. And of course, this is the day Stephen Hawking passed away, and I'm handing out flyers for an event about the Hubble Space Telescope. It was kind of ironic. But it was a windy day. It was a beautiful day. It was a beautiful spring day, and not quite spring yet, but one of the corners of the banners had come loose, and it was windy. And I was in an atrium that was mostly concrete and buildings and this big gazebo kind of thing that was 20 feet high or something. And this banner of these constellations was above me. And every time the wind would come through the campus, the quad there, the banner would snap and crack and just really loud. And everybody that was in the quad would look up and see the banner, the sky cracking, the sound of the crack. And it gave me goosebumps. I know this is sort of an emotive argument. It's not really philosophical or theological or anything, but it gave me goosebumps because instantly, almost like an epiphany, it was like one pillar of the universe that has been around for 6 or 7 decades, who was defining the cosmos for the popular imagination, had now passed. And it seemed like the heavens were unfurling and that Hawking was that one corner and torn from the fabric of the cosmos. I don't mean to say that disrespectfully to Stephen. In fact, at an event, we toasted Dr. Hawking and his contribution to cosmology. So I'm not one of those that championed, yay, that Mr. Hawking was dead. But the analogy of that cracking canopy having the stars on it, I think to me was somewhat terrifying to make sure that I'm exegeting the cosmos properly. Because at this point I was working on the book and I looked up at all the star names, it's very ancient names. Who knows where they come from, Babylon, Assyria, you know, Arabia. And here they were, and God seemed to be, you know, saying to me that in one sense, he wants to unfurl his glory. And in one sense, Hawking's materialistic naturalism was keeping that from the popular mindset. And so the very conversation in which God wants everybody to participate had been prevented. People had been prevented from not becoming scientists and physicists and being intimidated by science and physicists and not, ironically, not being able to have a voice conversation. And the heavens were designed for everybody, as I believe that, everybody to enjoy, everybody to understand. And in one sense, though, I think that the world, getting back to your final question, Steve, that the world that God created, this, I love this line from John Donne, immensity cloistered in thy dear womb. And so the creator of the universe, he's expressing the idea of the creator of the universe in the womb of Mary, now leaves his well-beloved imprisonment, and there hath made himself to his intent, weak enough now into our world to come. But oh, for thee, for him, hath the inn no room. And so Jesus came one time in the weakness of an infant, but a second time he is going to unfurl the heavens and come back as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Seeing that banner crack over my head and hearing that sound and looking at those stars, Steve, even for me as a Christian who claims to know that what the glory of God is, was scary, that the universe is going to be rolled up like a scroll. Jesus will come back, and that's it. But he came down into this world at first as an infant in the weakness of human flesh and suffered. Why he set it up that way, why this world, why this possibility of all the perhaps possible contingencies or counterfactuals that exist, I don't know.
Well, I have to apologize. I got some real quick. I have some people doing construction here, so let me keep this real brief so that I can eliminate the background noise. But I just want to address two things that he said real quick. One, Stephen Hawking was well familiar with Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which will basically say that if you take it as a whole, there is no possible theory of everything. So even Stephen Hawking realized that there is no one single theory that could describe all different things. Plus, he subscribed to a principle called modal-dependent realism, which it basically is a form of scientific instrumentalism. So he didn't really care so much if the theories actually exactly described reality, only that they worked. So he wasn't looking for a theory of everything. And also, in his own words, he was an atheist. I mean, he used God as some kind of metaphorical context, mostly like Spinoza's God or God of the philosophers. In his own words, he says, what I meant by we will know the mind of God is we will know everything that God would know if there was a God, which there isn't. I'm an atheist. So I just want to make sure we don't misrepresent Stephen Hawking, because he was an atheist.
I'm not using that. I assumed everybody knows that the context of that, what that context of that okay. quote was.
Well, I've read the history of time, and I'm familiar with it. It's been a long time ago, but there might be people that might have misconstrued what you said on that. Sure. But as far as possible, what's that?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I just assumed your audience would be familiar with what Stephen Hawking meant by God. That's all. But I would think that he still was interested in a theory of some unifying theory of quantum gravity. I mean, he was on the hunt for something that was much bigger than what we currently have, though.
But a quantifying theory is not a theory of everything. There's no one possible theory that could describe all possible states. It's a logical inconsistency in a system such as you can never logically prove all axioms in every single logical structure. You have to use multiple ones. That's why they overlap. And this is not one possible theory of everything. But anyways, you guys maybe know where I'm going with the possible world things. Scott, if you want to take on that, because the background noise is going to get bad here in a second. We've got a water leak, and so they're basically ripping into the walls right now.
I would just go back to, once again, like, if you want to look at the universe and cosmos and you want to think that there's some kind of creator behind it, that's absolutely fine. I think, but the bigger issue is when we're talking about, like, tonight's topic is, you know, is the Bible holy or unholy, right? You look at another big example would be Satan in the Bible. This is someone who manipulates human beings, leads them away from God. And once again, let's remember what the goal is. The goal is for God to have a loving relationship with us, and he cares about us and likes us and wants nothing more than a relationship, right? In fact, according to Christianity, you know, he sent his son to die on the cross for us and to go through that pain. But on the other hand, what does he do? He allows a being who doesn't have our best interest at heart, right in the very beginning, in the garden. Now, it doesn't specifically list Satan. They do call it the serpent. But typical Christian ideology would say that that is the devil, Satan. And what does he do? He leaves him with his creation. The very people who are sinless at this point that he cares about the most, and he allows a being who doesn't have their best interest at heart to wander around with them, right? And then he puts a tree that if they eat from it, they'll have knowledge of good and evil. And then, of course, there's a tree of life that he has to hide now, because not only, you know, they already, at that point, they had been tricked by the serpent. But you see throughout history, I mean, you look at the story of Job, where God basically makes a deal with the devil and makes a bet on that Job will never abandon him. And what does he do? He kills Job's children, kills all his cattle, all his animals. And weirdly enough, what happens at the end of the story, how does God reward him? He gives him a new wife, new children, and like abundance, basically. Like, that's such a, when you think about that, we wouldn't value that in human society. At this point, we wouldn't look at that and be like, okay, it's okay that you killed my wife, you killed my kids, you killed all, you gave me boils, you made me suffer and have all these diseases. You let this being do this to me. You let him torture humans and lead them away from you, which is very, very strange since your goal is to have a relationship with him. But somehow God allows Satan to do all this, right? And the only thing we're probably going to get and I'm not saying just from any of the Christians in the room, just generally I've ever heard from Christians, is God has morally sufficient reasons. When reason tells you this shouldn't make any sense, maybe we can address some of those issues.
I love the book of Job.
What's that, Wayne?
No, I love talking about the book of Job because I argue about this with one of my friends. He's like a fundamentalist evangelical. And book of Job is a theodicy, but I take it to be complete poetry, or else you have to deal with the fact, like you just said, like God killed his wife, his kids, his family, took everything away from him, gave him a terrible disease. No, by the way, I'm just going to give you a new family. I would completely agree with you, but that's not why I think it's complete poetry, but that's a very good reason as to why I just don't think it happened.
So you don't think the literal account of it, Wayne, real quick, you don't think there's a literal account of Job, either Job didn't exist or that story never happened?
I don't think Job historically happened. I think the point of Job, it literally was a theodicy. It literally was a story, a poetic story to try and explain what's going on in the midst of your struggle. And you actually can prove that with the Satan in Job, being that the Satan in Job or the adversary in Job is not Lucifer. It's not the great adversary. It's a completely different character.
The Satan would be the like the prosecuting attorney in a case, if I remember correctly. Dr. Josh, does he want to weigh in like the Satan as opposed to like the modern version of Christians that they have of Satan?
Oh, I mean, as far as if you look at the, you know, the 6th or 5th century book of Job, you know, the use of HaSatan there is, yeah, I mean, it's this idea that it's like the devil as we think of them. I don't think that's a fair representation of what the text is trying to do. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, later interpreters of that text didn't turn it into that. But, you know, I think Wayne's exactly right. HaSatan there is just the adversary. I mean, I think we read way too much into that as far as, you know, looking at the book of Job in and of itself. See, I think that's exactly right.
Well, Daniel, do you take the story of Job literally? Real quick,
take it literally? I spent a lot of time preparing on the book of Job for a lot of discussions I've had. It's one of the books in my Bible that is most marked up. And I think I would concede that what we have with the book of Job, I believe in terms of the content, one of the things that fascinated, yes, in order to answer your question, Steve, I think it happened. I think we're dealing with textual history here. There's a couple of other treatises that are not as, we have piecemeal treatises from the ancient world. Dr. Bowen can probably talk about this a lot more than I can. I'm a lot less familiar with them than I am with the book of Job, but the Protestations of the Eloquent Peasant. There are some Egyptian and some other ancient cultures that have stories piecemealed similar to the book of Job, but nothing like what we have in terms of the breadth and the depth and the eloquence of the book of Job. So if you have your English translations, if you have your Bibles with me, in chapter 3, Job gets his chance to speak after he is threshed by HaSatan, the adversary. Description of the adversary, it definitely would appear to me that the adversary has certain abilities and powers that God gives him. Job's health, the taking of the life, the Chaldeans who take the camels, the sheep that are stolen, that behind the actions, natural disasters and things that we see, at least in Job, we see that behind the actions are the actions of the HaSatan, which God gives the enemy permission to do. Fire fell from heaven. The Chaldeans came, you know, the boils. And I think probably one of the worst evils that Job experienced was that his breath stunk to his wife. I mean, that's a horrible thing, right? It's terrible. But anyway, chapter 3, Job's lament. So afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, I don't know all the Hebrew here, but if you go from verse 2 to verse 6, or even 7, if you count barrenness, there are 6 or 7 terms for the word darkness. And whoever wrote Job, if it was Job himself afterwards or whatever, you have some of the most enigmatic, deeply interesting, and hard to translate Hebrew in all of the Hebrew Bible. I consulted a friend of mine who teaches Hebrew at a seminary in St. Louis for help, exegetical help. I read a commentary all the way through and asked Tom for some exegetical help on Job. He's like, Job's the hardest book in the Bible to translate. And the writer is eloquent. I mean, he's just able to use for mining and traps, and the descriptions are incredible. And so he's crying out in anguish in the first two or three verses. Let the day perish on which I was born, a night, and the night which said a boy is conceived, that day may be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of that day terrify it. And so in Job's lament, I mean, he actually attributes things to God that he thinks God's against him. He thinks God hates him. His perceptions are not accurate. And there are some times in the Christian life, in my own Christian life, guys, where I can't tell the difference between whether or not I'm being harassed by Hasatan or whether or not the Lord is asking me to do something. It sometimes, as a Christian, it's a struggle to discern and to know what's going on in your life and to not have the full perspective. And I think, at least if nothing else, if you take Job as poetic or historical, I think that the ultimate lesson of Job is what we find in the end, where Job says, he confesses, I've heard of you, but now I've seen you, and I repent in sackcloth and ashes. And so even Job, an upright man, blameless, God still has to correct his perception of what God is doing with Job. Job doesn't fully know this. And I have done a word study on a star in the Big Dipper that I think is named after Job. I can't prove it, but I have a theory about one of the stars in the Dipper being named after after Job, as in terms of one thing that Job says about himself and one thing that God says about him at the end of the book. But that's for another story. But I think it's historical. I think it really happened, and I think it resonates with human suffering. We all, to some varying degrees, experience what Job does, and to the ultimate degree, I think that Jesus is suffering. God takes upon himself what Job goes through for us, and fellowship with us in our suffering and our sorrows. I mean, Isaiah 52 and 53, if you accept those as messianic, that Jesus is described as a man of sorrows. And this is the God who created the stars, that he is a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and he suffers. How is it that the creator of the universe suffers at the hands of his own creation? I don't know. Out of love, out of his love for us. That's how he expressed it. John 3:16 is the love that he expresses for us through his suffering. And that's comforting because of all the stuff that I've been through.
Well, here's the thing. Okay. I don't really feel like any of the points I made were actually addressed there. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but like, you just articulated what was in the story. Like, I get what's in the story. I mean, but let's speak plainly here, right? God allows, whether you want to call it Satan or the adversary, whatever we want to call this thing, right? He allows this thing to kill his children, have horrible boils. I think he kills his wife, if I recall, also on there. And for what reason? What, to give some kind of a lesson or story to future generations? Like, why? It's torturous and it's cruel. And if it's just to prove to the adversary, hey, listen, Job will never disobey me, you know. I mean, really? Like, is that how petty God is? Is that he has to prove to a being that's the adversary or Satan a point? Like, why aren't we just throwing this adversary or Satan in hell and leaving him there so he doesn't try to lead people away from him? He doesn't harm Job and his family. Replacing Job's wife and kids with another wife and more kids is frankly petty, in my opinion, and so unmeaningful. And I don't see how we get any kind of genuine goodness or good act or even growth from this story.
If I could just for a second, I mean, sort of give me what I think Skylar and I would say is the rationale for this type of writing, which is clearly, Daniel, as you say, very poetic and very difficult to translate. It's like doing Judges 5 or something. I mean, it's very complicated. But I think the rationale here is that this is an ancient Near Eastern motif, right? I mean, you have the Babylonian theodicy, this sort of thing of people wrestling with why do the gods do seemingly capricious things, right? And having etiological myths, etiological stories that try to describe some rationale behind it. It's just a common motif. And so seeing, you know, a late 6th, early 5th century book writing, from the Hebrew perspective, why it is that Yahweh can allow such, you know, horrific things to happen, or such wicked things, or such terrible things to happen, and yet still be justified. Again, that's, I think, just part of this broader literary motif from the period. So, I mean, I just want to make sure that it's clear, Schuyler. I don't think Schuyler is saying that there is no reason that this would be written. I think what he's saying is that, given, if we step into the maybe the stereotypical, common, whatever, Christian worldview, it doesn't make sense. If you step out of that and look at a broader ancient Near Eastern context without this necessary supernatural intervention, then it makes sense. And that rationale, or that rationally, I think, fits. So
just wanted to clarify. Well,
that's exactly right. And 90% of the Christians believe it's literal. Right. That's the point. Like if Wayne's opinion was the majority, I wouldn't even come up with issues with this scripture. I'd be like, oh, it's just a metaphor or analogy or some kind of way to tell us some story about a message. But that's not what Christians believe. 90% of them, like Daniel here, believe that it's a literal story. And then my brother was saying, like, it doesn't make any sense in that context. Like, this is, people have got to give up the ghost of the Bible and stop looking at it as if it's some kind of instruction manual or literal telling of history. You know, these are stories that help people, that people wrote to help understand difficult questions of suffering and things like that. But I know Daniel's probably waiting to respond here, so please.
No, gentlemen, I concur with the idea of the prevalence of man trying to understand what God is doing. There's something about that's part of the theme that, you know, began with the idea of struggling with God. But I think I just a simple question for, I guess, either of you. I've heard a few times about not making sense. And surely I'm not saying that I've got the bird's eye view of the throne in terms of why God does what he does. But I guess I would ask, in saying that if something doesn't make sense, do you think either of you would recognize, let's just say that there was a God and he did reveal himself to us in the ancient world? Do you think either of you would actually recognize the hallmark telltale signs of divine revelation from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago?
Well, Dr. Josh, should I answer that first, or do you want to answer it first?
I don't think I understand the question, so if you did, go ahead.
Okay, so if this isn't divine revelation, if this isn't, you know, Yahweh, if this isn't really God's revelation to man, how would you recognize if God in fact revealed himself, if he existed, and he revealed himself to us? Would you recognize that revelation as being genuinely coming from the God who is there?
Sure. So let me tell you some ways now how you would recognize it, right? The first way is it wouldn't contradict itself. Like when you look at something like, we use Corinthians, like love is kind, love is gentle. We go to that scripture, right? We have a definition of what love is there. Love does not boast. And then we take that definition of love and we see how God says he loves people, but yet he doesn't act in that way. He harms them multiple times. Now, so that would be a big sign. I think that I would be able to recognize that if it wasn't so contradictory, his moral character, his actions, contradictory in his goals, right? Because I'm just accepting certain premises built into the Christian religion, like God is perfect. He's all loving. He's kind. He wants a relationship with us. He's smart enough to build universes, planets, and human beings. So I figure like he could kind of He could work out a book in a way that would be understandable, non-contradictory, and could get the message part and get the message out there, I should say. But this is the other big problem, and I don't want to get on to this whole subject because I want to keep staying with Job. But like the fact that he would give his message to all mankind, to people thousands of years ago that were barely literate, that understood almost nothing about the world around them, in which it would have to be translated, passed by word of mouth, and then eventually put into books, and then expect people to understand him or come to him, that's part of the ridiculousness, in my opinion, of the whole religion. Like, if I, as a human being who's flawed and not a very smart man, everybody, right? Like, as my wife would say, but I got some talents. But if I can figure out a strategy in which I can communicate with humans to get my message across in my head, there's no excuse why God can't. Like, if he would just show up, like, and be like, hey, Skylar Fiction, I'm over here tonight. Let's talk a little bit, have a little bit of a relationship, right? Things would be all good. Then I would know he's there. I could talk to him. He could guide me. He could help me. I could gain some spirituality. But what I'm left with is reading a book that's thousands of years old, written from a culture that was very different and violent and harmful to each other, and then translated multiple languages. And then at the best, I guess Christians might say, I could pray and he'll answer those prayers and give me understanding. But it's ironic because so many Christians have different beliefs and different understandings of everything. It's not coherent. People believe people debate over the Trinity, over free will, whether God preordains people to heaven or hell. Some people don't even believe in hell. Some people in different kinds of hell. Like, there's so many different ways to view the religion. There's not even a clear standard to which we could choose. So that's how, I know it's a long-winded way to say that, but that's how I would be able to look at if God was trying to send a message and help us understand him or have a relationship with us, how at least it wouldn't contradict itself on every level.
So, Skylar, would you say that your exegetical understanding of the Bible being contradictory, so taking 1 Corinthians 13 back into Judges or something, that you're exegeting, so you've said the scriptures don't make any sense, and then you've sort of said that they seem contradictory and God would be more clear than he is in what we have. But there's two things I've noticed. One is that you've articulated the gospel message very clearly. I think there is a way that it can be understood, and you do seem to understand it. But my bigger question would be, you must be thinking that you're exegeting the text properly if you know they're contrary to themselves. In other words, it seems like all Christians are goofed up about everything and we're confused, but then the skeptical position seems to be exegetically the default in terms of, this is really what it means. It's full of contrary errors and things like that. Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that is the proper way to look at the text?
You make a good point, right? Yeah. Oh, please. No, please, Dr. Josh, please.
Or Dr. Bowen.
I mean, this is sort of what I was alluding to earlier is this idea that, when you're in, and I feel very qualified is not the word I'm searching for, but I can't think of a better one. I feel okay maybe about saying this because I was a Bible believing fundamentalist conservative evangelical Christian for almost 30 years, and so I feel like I've been very clearly well entrenched on both sides of this issue. And one of the things that I see, particularly looking back, is that if there's a possible answer, that's all that's really necessary. So for example, I'm doing a video now, putting it together on the formation of the Pentateuch or the Hexateuch, whatever you want to call it, whatever it is that you want to think about it. But of the early portions of the biblical text, let's just say the Pentateuch for fun. There's just no question. I just don't think there's any question that you have a very complicated, complex, and chronologically lengthy, at least somewhat lengthy, editorial and redactionary process that went into putting the Pentateuch together, right? And I don't think that Moses really had much of anything to do with it, if Moses existed. Now, one of the things that I see now, and I remember doing it when I was a Christian, is looking at these contradictions, for example, in the book of Genesis, or doublets in the book of Genesis, or stories in the text and anticipate other things that are contradictory to other things. And so these problems of the text from a literary standpoint, even from a logical standpoint, you know, the naming of a particular place two different times in two different ways by two different people, and having that be the way that the name was changed, or sometimes by the same person. You know, so these things that I think that if we took them out of the Bible and we put them into Enuma Elish, for example, into the story of Marduk and his enthronement, if we put those doublets, if we put those contradictions in Enuma Elish, I don't know that I doubt any Christian would have any problem agreeing. Well, yeah, those two things contradict one another. And if somebody said that held to that, believed in Marduk, part of the Mesopotamian religion, said, no, we can explain these doublets actually because Marduk here is using this old phrase, and it's possible that what he's referring to is, and in his mind, it makes sense. We would look at that and say, yeah, okay, that's possible. But I mean, you have 60 of these, right? So are we going with the possible 60 different times? That's what I see happening in the biblical text. Again, I did it, right? So, you know, I'm as guilty of this as anybody. Because if there is a possible explanation, then that's all that's really necessary. We go with that, and then we say, look, there is no contradiction because it's possible that this is true. I see this a lot with, and then I'll be quiet, sorry. Sometimes I realize how long I'm speaking, but not till the end of that. Something like Ezekiel 26, right? Ezekiel 26 and the prophecy against Tyre. You know, the text clearly talks about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the loan agent. That's it. And Ezekiel gets it wrong. And it's, I mean, like, I don't think that's a huge problem. I don't even think that's a huge problem for someone like my wife who wants to be a Christian, because I just don't think that's relevant to her belief structure.
Do you think, just a thought on that 26, are you talking about, do you distinguish between the mainland of Tyre and the siege mound that was built later by Alexander?
Yeah, so Alexander's not in Ezekiel 26 at all.
No, I mean I'm assuming your error is the actual you're thinking of the actual location of Tyre in that prophecy.
No, so the islands. I've got a video that I just did on this on our channel. Please check it out. No, the island city of Tyre is the subject of destruction that Nebuchadnezzar is supposed to bring, and he doesn't. And he says it in Ezekiel 29. I mean, I won't go into the details here, but I mean, there's from in my opinion and mainstream scholarship's position, you know, that there is no Alexander in the text, right? There's not this hidden, you know, many nations are going to come up against you, and that somehow refers to later nations, or a switch in pronouns in verse 12. You can watch my video, and I go into that in great detail. But nonetheless, let's assume for what I'm saying here, Ezekiel 26 is just for better or for worse, a failed prophecy, right? But because people come to that text and say, well, isn't it possible that this grammatical structure shifting here, isn't it possible that it's referring later, 240 or whatever years later, to Alexander coming? Isn't that possible? Well, no, I don't think so. But let's say that it is possible. Are we going with what's possible or what's highly plausible, and doesn't require, I don't want to say tap dancing, but I mean exegetical shifting to a high degree, reading things into the text that just simply aren't there. That's the problem that I see.
Is it?
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I appreciate the input. I just went through Ezekiel a couple months ago. The information historically, so you believe in the of the Amarna letters, Dr. Bone? I mean, you know what those are, right? Between the Hittites and Egypt and 18th dynasty.
Yes, I translated a number of them.
So are you familiar with the correspondence between, I can never pronounce his name, Supalulumina? how you pronounce it, the stupid name. Sipulalima. Not stupid, but yeah, Sipulalima. The correspondence between him and what scholars apparently believe is King Tut's widow. Are you familiar with that letter?
Sure. I mean, the Amarna period. Sorry, in the Amarna period is 14th century, 13th century. So,
yeah, right. So, okay. So, but are you familiar with the exchange between him and Queen Tut?
Or the alleged, I don't know the particular letter that you're describing. Go ahead.
Okay, so there's an interpretive context. They're not the pharaoh whose sudden death has led to this request is called the Nifururia, if I'm killing that. We don't get Tutankhamun out of that. My point with this is that there's historical speculation that the person writing this particular letter was the widow of King Tut. But what we don't, so if like a layman's reading this, I mean, I'm a layman and I read it, there's a great deal of scholarship that goes into thinking that this name is particularly related to this person, or a lot of place names like that, or a lot of chronology is like that, to where we are filling in the gaps anachronistically from a modern contextual standpoint. I'm not saying that the Amarna letter author was Queen Tut or the pharaoh's wife, but the Amarna letter that describes, she's asking for the hand in marriage of one of the Hittite princes. Prior to this letter, the Hittites and the Egyptians had been, you know, at loggerheads, you know, combatively. And essentially, she's trying to make peace because something has happened to her husband is dead. We don't know what happened. But she's trying to make peace. And so the king can't believe this. He sends an emissary. It's true. One prince makes his way over to Egypt and he's killed along the way. We don't have all the details. We have some text here from the Amarna letter, a particular Amarna letter. But we are left with having to fill in the details. And so it's not like scripture or any ancient text, I think, gives us the full and comprehensive story that we would like. Empirically speaking, is like astronomy. We're looking back at the ancient world in pieces. But we don't have the whole context. And so I think that possibility, my whole point with this is that possibility exists on both sides, Dr. Bowen. It seems like you have a possible way in which this probably was not fulfilled. And, you know, exegetical evangelical scholars have possibilities as well. And the reason those exist for both of us is because we do not have all the contextual archaeological details of the context in which these things happen.
Yeah, so I'm going to push back on you a little bit. There's a difference between, not having all of the details to know about every facet of a historical event. It would be amazing if we had that, right?
Great. I'd be like, yay, that's great. You know.
Yeah, I mean, But we don't, right? Right. And one of the things that we see from the ancient Near East is that instead of having what we might consider to be like a broad, I keep turning Siri on when I say something about the ancient Near East. What we don't have is oftentimes sort of this broad light that illuminates a period. We have, you know, a very fine, bright light that illuminates certain parts in certain places, right? We have an archive that we find, something like the Amarna period. We know a fair amount about the Amarna period.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not saying like, that.
Or, yeah. No, I know you're not. But, you know, something like a prophecy in Ezekiel, right, where Ezekiel is giving very specific detail about what's going to happen, right? If you want to argue that it's hyperbolic language, I have no problem with that, right? But the essential nature of that text, the essential point of that prophecy, if prophecy means anything, and you know, Robert Chisholm in his 2010 article cites this, cites is not the right word, admits is the word that I'm searching for, that even if it's hyperbolic language, essentially, the prophecy fails, right? And what I'm saying is that from a historian, somebody that works with ancient texts, even though I'm much more on a literary side and a liturgical side, somebody that works in the ancient world that deals with these texts and tries to piece together the historical periods, based on the knowledge that we have archaeologically, art historically, contextually, or textually, what I find happening is that scholarship in general, right, very broadly, for example, in something like Ezekiel 26, says we have something very specific. It says it was going to be Nebuchadnezzar. Not only did it not happen, but Ezekiel says that it didn't happen in chapter 29. Then, of course, he makes another prophecy about how they're going to Nebuchadnezzar is going to go to Egypt, and that really doesn't happen either. But nonetheless, they look at a text like that. I look at a text like that and say, okay, that's fine. I mean, Ezekiel got it wrong. It's not like the end of the world, right? But for an evangelical scholar, and I mean an evangelical scholar that holds to a very specific view of the inerrancy of the text, and I would not say, I have a lot of evangelical scholar friends, that would not in any way hold that Ezekiel 26 is you know, somehow referring to Alexander or later nations. So it's not about being evangelical. It's about having a particular view of the text where a prophecy can't fail. And so you have to somehow figure out a way, not you, but people have to figure out a way that Ezekiel actually didn't get it wrong, right? And maybe he didn't understand it completely. Chisholm, of course, argues, if you've read that article, I don't know if you have, but it's fairly popular in the community. You know, Chisholm argues that that it's a contingent prophecy and that somehow Tyre repents. And so, you know, it's the same thing with Egypt. We don't really know why, but Egypt somehow repented.
He's arguing like Nineveh.
That's exactly right. Yeah, something overt like Nineveh is an implicit contingent. He argues that, I don't know that he would argue that all prophecies are contingent, but maybe most are implicitly contingent. And I think when you do that, it sort of tips your hand that you're just trying to make the square peg fit in the round hole. You have to have a possible solution. And what I'm saying is, given that the Bible is not this text that's written in a vacuum, that's unique in that respect amongst, and it's not even early among all the other ancient Near Eastern texts, and that it looks so much like the other ancient Near Eastern texts, let's let it be one, right? And not try to hold it to this standard that we don't hold other ancient Near Eastern texts to, because I don't think that's what the writers were trying to do.
Well, you make an excellent point about historical context. I mean, if we read, you know, I like Jane Austen, but if we read novels from the late 18th century, we can pretty much classify a body of literature in one particular way. So the similarities with the ancient Near East, I don't have any problem with the similarities that you would find. I mean, that's sort of the argument.
By the way, Daniel, just as a side note, and I want you to get on Skylar about this, because he asked me if I could have a movie on a desert island. I could only have one. What would it be? And I said Pride and Prejudice. You know, he got all over me. So
yeah, I really got Pride and Prejudice and Wuthering Heights, and I wanted to kill myself.
No.
I'm not a fan of any of
that. Sorry, go ahead.
So here's just completely side note. Heathcliff. But you all know who William Herschel was? He discovered Uranus. He and his sister Caroline were lay astronomers who worked in the English resort town of Bath. And Dr. Bowen, you know Bath. What is Bath for Jane Austen? It's like the Vegas of England, right? Well, it's not quite Vegas. It was, you know, it was moral, but Bath was the resort town where everybody in the Austen novels would go. It was a real town, and they would go have balls and dancing and things like that. And William Herschel composed music for dancing and performed at Bath while he was doing telescopic observations of his sister Caroline. Just a kind of a cool little side note anyway. My point with the novel is that I have absolutely no problem with, I obviously texts are going to have similarities with the cultures by which around it. I mean, if you look at Exodus and God is saying, don't be like the other nations. So there's obviously a connectivity, culturally speaking, that I think we do a disservice to ourselves, whether we're Christians or atheists, in not trying to understand that. I completely agree with that. So when it comes to the text of Ezekiel 26 to 29, there's contextual information, I think, that allows for us, you know, you have people who want to maybe, as you say, maybe we are trying to jam something in there that's not happening. Maybe it did happen precisely as Ezekiel happened. We just don't have all the other information. Maybe it's the question for me with Ezekiel and other texts as well is the distance of time and just the way we can know history in general. And I think so if you take the fulfillment or what we would look for as the fulfillment or the lack of the fulfillment of the prophecy, we are bereft of specific. I mean, we don't have exact day-to-day calendar chronology of Nebuchadnezzar's actions in the ancient Near East when he was the Babylonian potentate. We don't have a whole record of what he. So I think there's a possibility for everybody to be able to sort of, you know, fill in the gaps historically that we don't have. So to say, for me, if someone were to say, well, this was just simply not fulfilled, is filling in more there on the other side of the coin than what I think is available. And really what, I would say there's possibilities, but I think it's the possible aspects of it. It's a both and that you can have possibility.
How would you handle chapter 29? I mean, let's take for granted that we don't know, right? There's actually a fair amount that we do know about it. Not a lot, right? Outside of Ezekiel, we have some administrative text, but certainly Ezekiel knew, right? So what do you do in that situation with Ezekiel 29?
Are you talking about what the latter part of it or which?
Yeah, what is it, verse 17, where he says every head was rubbed bare and, shoulders rubbed bare, but he couldn't take it?
Right, saying, son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made his army hard labor against Tyre. Every head was made bald, every shoulder was rubbed bare, but he and his army had no wages from Tyre for the labor that he had performed against it. Therefore, thus the Lord God, behold, I shall give the land of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and he will carry off her wealth and capture her spoil and seize her plunder, and it will be wages for his army. So if we're going back, so you're saying that Ezekiel is saying that 29 negates 26. Is that what you're contesting?
Yeah, I mean, he's saying that,
he said he did not profit. He did not profit from Tyre. He worked hard at it.
But that's specifically what 26 said he would do.
Okay, so well, he does work hard against it, and so we're in 26. Well, let me see.
What is it?
So he 14. There's a destruction. 14. I will make you a bare rock, a place for the spreading of nets. You'll be built no more. So that's what's spoken of against Tyre.
It might be. 13. I don't see. Yeah, I don't remember. I'm not looking at the text.
So he's talking about the city of Tyre, but for Nebuchadnezzar, he's just saying you're going to sit and you're going to make siege walls and you're going to cast things against it and blow his battering rams and do all this stuff. But in 26, we're not told that he's going to get Tyre for an inheritance.
We do, though. I mean, so he's going to break down the walls. They're going to run through the streets. They're going to plunder. The text, and again, I'm pulling this from memory. I don't have the text in front of me, but.
Hey, Dr. Josh, what's the actual scripture? Maybe I could pull it up real quick.
It's Ezekiel 26. 26. I think it's 12, 13, 14, somewhere around there.
Yeah, all right.
He will destroy your pleasant houses and throw your stones and your timbers and your debris into the water. So I will silence the sound of your songs. I don't see in the text in 26, I don't see Nebuchadnezzar being prophesied that he's going to actually profit from the destruction that he brings to Tyre. But 29.
Can I read the scripture? Can I just read the scripture for everybody? Because I think it kind of does refer to that. So if we start at verse 7, for this is what the sovereign Lord says. From the north, I am going to bring against Tyre Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots, with horsemen and a great army. He will ravish your settlements on the mainland with the sword. He will set up siege works against you, build a ramp up to your walls, and raise his shields against you. He will direct the blows of his battering rams against your walls and demolish your towers with his weapons. His horses will be so many that he will cover you with dust. Your walls will tremble at the noise of the war horses, wagons, and chariots. When he enters your gates, as men enter a city, whose walls have been broken through. The hooves of his horses will trample all your streets. He will kill your people with the sword, and your strong pillars will fall to the ground. They will plunder your wealth and loot your merchandise. They will break down your walls and demolish your fine homes and throw you stones, timber, and rubble in the sea. I will put an end to your noisy songs, and the music of your harps will rumble in the sea. I will put an end to your noisy, I will make you a bare rock, and you will become a place to spread fishnets. You will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken, declared the sovereign thing. So it straight up says that they're going to take your loot and your merchandise. It actually says they're going to be rocks, and it will never be rebuilt, which is strange, because now it's referring to later on, I guess, in that next verse that Josh had brought up, that the city's still there, and people still live there. And not everybody's been killed here, because it says he will kill your people with the sword. Did it say all the people at one point? But like, I think that's pretty clear that they're going to ravage the city and destroy everything.
Well, the destruction is clear, and there's no question that Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar did that. There's no question.
That he did what?
That Nebuchadnezzar came against Tyre.
But sorry,
they will plunder your wealth. Your merchandise. That was what was in dispute just a couple of months ago.
Right. So so again, this gets back to a very specific ambiguity that you can make a case for a possibility in both directions. So here's how this could work. You could read spoil verse 12 as though the Babylonians, after they took all that stuff, made a profit from the stuff that they took. You could say that. You could certainly say that. It strongly looks like that is implied. If you go to 20,
I don't know if that's what that says. I think it says they will plunder your wealth and loot your merchandise.
They will plunder it. Okay, so they will take, what's being told here is that Tyre is being, your stuff is going to be taken. Your stuff is going to be taken as spoil. It's going to be
by Nebuchadnezzar.
By Nebuchadnezzar. Correct. Now, so we can interpret that the army will take your stuff. There's no question about that. We can make that text. But if we go to 29, and we go to the text where it says,
I will make you a bare rock. Like, they weren't a bare rock at that point afterwards. It says that you will become a place to spread fishnets. You will never be able to rebuild.
Right.
How is there still a city if they were able to rebuild?
That's what I said to Dr. Bowen about the historical ambiguity, that in the context of that time, that certainly could have been fulfilled, and we don't know. To the extent that was Tyre, the empire of what it was, in that context, historically speaking, it never rose to the prominence that it was prior to Nebuchadnezzar. You could look at it that way. But again, not having the thoroughgoing contextual evidence, except just Ezekiel and a few other extant manuscripts, or, you know, I believe that text right there is talking about the prominence of Tyre as it was prior to the invasion of Babylon. But going into 29, for what it says in 29, but he and his army had no wages from Tyre for the labor that he had performed against it. Something happened to the stuff that Nebuchadnezzar took that the army and Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon was not able to profit from what they did.
Okay, this is Daniel. This is specifically what I'm talking about, right? So if all we had were Ezekiel 29 or 26 and 29, I still think it would be an incredible stretch to say that. But maybe you could say it. But we don't, right? Some of the things that we have...
The Babylonians left Tyre and went and spent money on a trip to Vegas. It doesn't give us what did the Babylonians do with the stuff they took from the city of Tyre. We don't know.
Okay.
Ezekiel tells us it seems like they didn't profit from it. They got stuff, but somehow, for whatever reason, it didn't increase their wealth. They weren't paid by the spoil they took from Tyre. Something happened. We can say that. And I think we can say it in both directions, Dr. Bowen. You can say it wasn't fulfilled based on the
text. I strongly disagree for a couple of reasons. One, the main point of Ezekiel 26 and also later of Ezekiel 29 is that the island city was not taken. That's the point. And the reason that it's the point is because several kings had tried to do it in very recent history, right? And Alexander was the one that actually was able to do it. So to try to pull this and to tease out, first of all, shalal, bazaz, these words that are used in 26.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I can't hear you. But, the word to plunder, to spoil, are used both in 26 and in 29. And the point of the text in 26 is you're going to get in to this exceptionally wealthy city of Tyre, right? It's in the midst of the sea. It's like the gem in the midst of the sea. He's going to get in there and he's going to tear it down and he's going to stomp it into the ground. He's going to get all the spoil. And then he's going to go back and that's the definition of plundering, right? It's the definition of spoiling. And 29 specifically says he didn't do it, right? And now his plunder, now his spoil is going to be Egypt, which of course he also did not get. But I think this is my point, right? I'm going to grant you, just to make my point, that we could somehow allow for this nuance that the Babylonian army, after 13 years, even though we have external evidence, particularly later and contemporaneous evidence that says that he didn't get in, I'm gonna just say that that meant that he got in, he got all the plunder, he got all the riches and wealth, and then spent it. And that meant that he didn't make any gain from it because they blew it at the local Vegas. I mean,
I'm not saying that they spent. I'm not even saying they spent it. I'm saying we don't know what he did with it.
Okay, so he dropped it on the way home. I mean, like, I'm sorry, I don't mean this rude, but as ridiculous as that sounds, I'm going to grant it, right, that it's a possibility. It's within the realm of possibility. Embracing that in lieu of the plain reading of the text and of the historical period, and not just the plain reading, but like the overwhelmingly convincing reading of the text. That's the point that I'm trying to make, is that if you're inside of this thing, if you're inside of this Christian perspective, this Christian worldview, and it has to be true, again, and it sounds like, Daniel, to you, it has to be true, because if it's not, there's going to be some fundamental shift, some paradigm shift that your faith won't allow. I don't know that, but it sounds like it. And I know a lot of people that have this, right? I was one of them. And what I'm saying is that going to an ancient text and putting these types of constraints on it and trying to tease out a possibility and holding on to that, as opposed to just dealing with what the text says in and of itself, and then shifting your paradigm, changing your model to allow for it, that's the problem that I'm trying to point out here.
No, I completely understand the approach and appreciate your insight and your experience on both sides of the fence, Dr. Moe. And I don't contest your knowledge about these texts at all. But something between 26 and 29, I mean, you talk about what the plain reading of the text is. And it sounds like, when you say that, it sounds as if that you know conclusively that Ezekiel was wrong. Or that, so in other words, Ezekiel wrote this, if we're going to grant his authorship. And this has been extant for centuries. Certainly, he had a knowledge of that particular part of the world that is lost to us. And what he conveys to us is not the exhaustive, comprehensive treatise of what happened back then. And
but it need
so
not
I
be.
Think. But the exegetical sword cuts both ways, sir. I think that you can be predisposed to think that Ezekiel had to be wrong. And that's an exegetical interpretation.
I'm not predisposed to think that.
I'm not saying you are.
I'm not saying. Sorry. You're saying you generally.
No. I got you. In a general sense. Yeah. That one can be predisposed to see this text exegetically as incorrect and a failure of prophecy. And you can sort of be stuck in that mindset, like an evangelical might be stuck in the mindset of not being familiar with the culture or the context.
Absolutely.
And just jamming something in there that's not there. So all I'm saying is that interpretive exegetical constructs, the danger, if you will, of being locked in if you will, to the text, or the plain reading of the text. We always like to use that. I mean, I've been guilty of that. It's just the plain reading, right? I'm interpreting it right, and you're interpreting it wrong, or you're interpreting it wrong, and I'm interpreting it right. I think for me, there's a great deal of you know, I don't know. I mean, if this passage was like Ezekiel made a prophecy and it was wrong, and if I grant to you what you've said, this does not shake or change my faith at all. In fact, because I have no problem with it if it was completely reversed in terms of its meaning, and if you were absolutely right about what you just said to me, there is absolutely no challenge to my faith whatsoever. It would cause me to go back to the text, dig it out, and see what people have read, what is the consensus on it, and go back and re-examine it. I've done that 100 times. But this little glitch.
If I could, who have you read that supports Ezekiel 26 not being a failed prophecy, just for the in these terms, these general terms, besides like Gleason Archer? I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot. Do you remember any?
You know, I have commentaries. I read a lot of commentaries, so I have.
Yep.
They are behind me. It would take about 2 minutes for me to find it. But
no, it's okay. If you could maybe email them to me, because I'd be interested to know. You know, Gleason Archer is sort of a fallback for a lot of people, right? And I have obviously a lot of problems with his scholarship, but nonetheless, he's a name that comes up a lot. And if there's somebody that has an axe to grind, it's Gleason Archer. And I don't think that even... Let me shift for 2 seconds to something that's even more debated, right? That I just did a video on, the book of Daniel, the dating of the book of Daniel. People will go to the wall for a 6th century writing, a 6th century authorship of Daniel. I mean, it has to be, right? And I have, it's completely unnecessary. And I think just flies in the face of everything that we see from a linguistic standpoint, from a contextual standpoint. It's just so unbelievably problematic, in my opinion, to hold to anything earlier than like a 4th century. And I still think 4th is very early writing of the book. But the lengths that people will go to, and I don't think they need to. Chung Myung Seow, for example, has a commentary. It's not a very big one, but you know, Seow is an evangelical scholar. His introduction to the book is, we need to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, it's like we need to have these in Sunday school so that we can understand the book of Daniel in its context. And he is one of the stronger proponents of a late date of the book of Daniel. So I sometimes come up against these things, and I kind of hit my head against the wall and say, evangelical scholars, like academics, evangelical academics don't hold these positions. So when we talk about like what scholarship says, what's the majority, what's the consensus view, it's not these positions that I argue against. I don't argue. I just almost refuse the majority of the time to argue anything that's not mainstream consensus view.
Can I say something really quickly too, just before we move on? I don't know if it's being over, like being missed right here, but, okay. Tyre, is this the same city that is in modern day Lebanon right now that we would consider?
I would assume there was probably, I think so. I'm geographically, I have to go back and look. I was totally prepared.
Phoenicia, now it's Lebanon.
Okay. Yeah. Just to be clear. But hold on, real quick, really, 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 really quickly. Just let me finish my thought here. I just want to clarify. Right now, we go back to verse 13. I will put an end to your noisy songs, and the music your harps will be heard no more. I will make you a bare rock, and you will become a place to spread fish nets. You will never be rebuilt. The city was never reduced to rubble. There obviously has been rebuilt. You guys just admitted this. That is now the city in Lebanon. So right there, the prophecy is wrong. We don't even need to go to 19. Like, it said the place would be rubble. It said it would all be plundered. It said that all the singing, the voices, it said the people would be killed. Obviously, when we go to 19, it's still referring to a city being there. and it's not all rubble because people still live there. And nowadays, the city's been rebuilt. So this is a failed prophecy even on that level.
Well, I think, yeah, Skylar...
real quick, the Caesar of Tyre, when Alexander conquered it, he didn't raise the village, right? He didn't conquer and kill everybody, right? I mean, he basically gave them amnesty or pardoned them in some ways, but he let them continue. It's still a viable city now in Lebanon, well, area in Lebanon, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think he had a pretty...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, there was a pretty significant slaughter, and I'm not a historian of the Greco-Roman history, but I understand there was a pretty significant slaughter, probably out of frustration with Alexander. But that land bridge that he built has, you know, formed over, you know, the millennia, a peninsula, but it is the same. It's the same place, right? It's just there's now a peninsula that leads out to it because of what Alexander did.
Right.
My understanding, guys, and again, I didn't do my homework on, I would have gone more deeper into it, but as I understand it, and this is just where my understanding is, I'm not saying that my understanding means that this is the truth, but as I understand how my current structure in my head about this is that Nebuchadnezzar decimated the mainland city, but did not dislodge the island city that Alexander later laid a siege mound to destroy the island city, and that the island part was razed completely by Alexander. So it was like 332 whenever Alexander did it. So I understand it as Nebuchadnezzar taking the mainland, and then Alexander later, a couple centuries later, taking the island city with a siege mound. That's how I...
So a couple of things. So... the mainland cities, that was like par for the course, right? If you read back through the history of New Assyrian kings that come up against the mainland city of Tyre, Phoenicia is this, you know, it's like this road, not, it's like this pathway down to Egypt, right? You need to make sure that you're not leaving yourself exposed and vulnerable on the Phoenician coastline, right? So the first thing that people do when they come to this area is they take out the mainland cities. Whether they destroy them, whether they make a strong showing against them and get them to pay tribute and to submit, you know, those sorts of things happen. But I mean, like, I think it was Ashurbanipal on his way back from a campaign takes Ushu, the mainland city, what they called Old Tyre, right? So, I mean, it's not like the mainland city is tough. The other thing that we know historically, just from the inscriptions, if nothing else, is that the way to besiege the island city of Tyre, which were always kept distinct. And you can see that in the inscriptions. It'll say the islands on the land, or the Tyre that's on the land, and or the city that's on the land and the city that's in the midst of the sea, right? The way that you lay siege to Tyre, the island, is to simply create a blockade on the mainland, right? You cut off Ushu. Ushu had walls, right? We think probably some fairly significant fortifications, excuse me, not nearly as many as what we see even depicted at the island city. But there is, you know, there is some fortifications. The reason is there were springs inside of Ushu, and the mainland city supported the island city of Tyre, right? Later on, they learned how to dig down and create, I guess, cisterns or, you know, whatever, but then become a little more self-sustaining. But nonetheless, the first step when you went to take the island city of Tyre was to just cut off the mainland from it, right? So that's the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar did. It's the first thing that every other king did. So this idea, like, it's been argued that the siege was laid against the mainland city of Ushu for 13 years, and it was laid in such a way that it allowed people to sneak out the back door for 13 years, take all their treasures and riches with them, and go to the island city. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar breaks in and goes, oh my gosh, what the hell? Nonsense, right? I'm sorry to say that, but it's nonsense. The first thing that he did was take the mainland city. You can even see it in the text. And then he lays siege to the island city by cutting off those supply lines. That's what they did. So I think that there's so much evidence in support, not only that he was laying siege to the island city for the 13 years, or the bulk of it, right? and that he did not take the island city, which is what Ezekiel prophesied that he would do, and that Ezekiel says he didn't do it in 29.
Where does it make the distinction between the island and the mainland in 26? Where do you see that?
Yeah, let's go to it.
I see in verse 6, also her daughters who are on the mainland will be slain by the sword. But on the main, I see verse 8 on the mainland with the sword and battering rams and all that. I don't know.
She will be a place, verse 5, for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea. It's the phrase the island city of fire.
So she will be a place. Now, okay, that's a distinct characteristic of what will happen. In verse 3, though, in the context.
On the mainland with the sword, verse 8.
What do you think, Dr. of I will bring many nations against you? How do you look at that one historically?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a paper on this and then made this video that everybody can go to our channel. And when they do subscribe, we're like 41 subs away from 5,000. I just noticed. So we'll plug there. Thank you for that, Daniel.
The link is in the video description now. So click on that.
Because I'll just quickly so I can, you can kind of answer this more.
Yeah, we got to start wrapping this up. Oh, and we do have super chats. We're already at 2 hours. So go ahead and say what you got to say. And then, like I said, I got one or two things to add real quick, and then we're going to do the super chats, and maybe there might be a question you want to hold off, Daniel.
No, I have looked at many nations. So for me, and this is just me, and I'll go back and dig through a little bit more. I look at the things that God says, I will bring many nations against you. And then, so what happens in there could possibly be filled in by not just Nebuchadnezzar, but later Alexander as well.
I deal specifically with this in the video. And if you become a Patreon, I think a $5 Patreon, you can get the paper that I wrote. But I actually read the paper in the video. So, I mean, you can get the video. But I deal, that's one of the two main points that I deal with is this many nations. So.
Okay. Well, let me just add one or two things, a caveat, because we have to move on to wrap this up. One, you know, Bertrand Russell came up with something called bare possibilities, which is basically, okay, yeah, something's possible. You know, Nebuchadnezzar could have like had aliens take him up and take away his treasure, therefore his loot's gone or whatever. There could be an infinite amount of bare possibilities. And one of the things that we have to take into account, if you allow for some kind of credulity to any of these and all of these possibilities, it just bloats your ontology to no end. I think when I'm listening to apologetics, and no disrespect to you, Daniel, but when I listen to apologetics, it literally is this accounting of bare possibilities and saying, well, it could be this. Oh, it could be that. The plain reading of the scriptures and the principle behind the clarity of scriptures seems to discount the need to have that many hoops you have to go through in order to try to read anything to fit the narrative that you're ascribing to. When it comes to like prophecies, seem to be always contingent upon things in some degree. But if a prophecy comes true to most people, it's not going to be a game changer. I think if we found out that this prophecy was the case, I don't think either Dr. Bowen or Skyler would go, okay, yeah, a Christian, right? But to somebody who actually believes that prophecies are the case, a failed prophecy is devastating. You can't just, you know, move past that because a prophecy for any would be determinant that they're not actual according to the scriptures. So I think there's and again, I don't mean this disrespectfully, but I think there is a cognitive bias there that you have to find reasons for the finding that these are not failed prophecies, as opposed to somebody like Dr. Bowen, who honestly doesn't really have a dog in the fight. I mean, he's plain face. So I don't think he has to say, well, you know, in order for me to stay atheist or agnostic or whatever, I have to show that this prophecy didn't come true. Does that kind of make sense?
No, I think the axiomatic starting point of looking at texts from the ancient Near East, you begin with certain evidentiary axiomatic ideas about what you're looking at. And you can come at this with saying this is a failed prophecy, or you can come at this with, you know, saying, I'm not sure if it's a failed prophecy, or you can come at this with saying, no, it's probably true, and I just don't have all the information. And so like I said a few minutes ago, I hold it with an open hand. I think there is more information that we don't have, but I fully believe, and when you interpret history, there are always possibilities on both sides, and you have to land on one point or the other in regards to that. And I am not to avoid going back and looking at something. I will certainly go back and look at the stuff that I looked at about a month ago or two, and just kind of rehash it. But no, I'm perfectly willing to examine it and see why, and have further discussions. It's how I learn. And that's what kind of what I wanted to come on tonight. I wanted to learn.
Yeah, no, and we live these kinds of discussions, and we do appreciate you coming on. Hope that you and Dr. Bowen can maybe continue onwards and get a dialogue on that. Yes, Dr. Bowen.
Just 5 seconds. What I would say in light of that, and to maybe be like a challenge to maybe your interpretive approach, if you're looking for that, is we have a lot of Mesopotamian, particularly in Akkadian prophecies, right? Particularly in the New Assyrian period. They're well published in translation. If you go back and read through those prophecies, would you go to the same lengths to try to reconcile them if they fail? And why? And I don't want you to answer that, but I mean, it's something I think to think about, because the Bible is not alone in its prophecies, right? I mean, like, this is an ancient Near Eastern thing. Yeah, so
but I think you have to have a standard by which you measure failure or success of a prophecy. I think that gets to the heart of your question.
Well, I agree, but I think Skylar kind of wrapped it up pretty well that, you know, if you look at it just direct on, I mean, the prophecy does seem to have failed. I mean,
you say the key word there, Steve. It seems. And I agree, it seems like.
Well, yeah, again, like, I mean, these are all subjective things to some degree. I mean, we all have our own biases. We all have the way of looking at, you know, we're all kind of having a persuasive argument here. I mean, people come on and they have the listen and say, okay, who's more convincing? And now, granted, all the people in here are very erudite and, you know, very educated on the topic, especially on the Bible, far more than I could ever hope to be. So it's not a matter of like a cult of personality, who's more likable. I mean, don't side with Skylar or Dr. Bowen because you happen to like them over Dan or something like that. Dan, you're very personable.
I like them both.
They're great. Well, they're two of my favorite people. But when I'm looking as an observer and I'm just having to look, okay, how do I look at this prophecy? I don't very little. We've talked about it before, I guess. But I have to say, you know, to me, it appears to be a failed prophecy. Now, as you said, well, its appearances are seeming, but that's all a person can really go by. So when people look into this, they have to make their own judgments on it. But maybe there could be more communication between you and Dr. Bowen on this, and he can kind of, you know, give you the more technical aspects of the biblical history on it, and see if you don't, you know, change your position on it. And if you do, you know, maybe or maybe not change your whole paradigm. I don't know. To me, if there's a failed prophecy, it kind of is indicative of the Bible maybe not being as able to predict the future as much as it thinks it's able to, right? I don't
think
that much.
In 25 years, I've had my exegetical eyes open to many things. And I'm not... I personally, obviously, I think it is a fulfilled prophecy to some extent, but obviously I think there's information that's missing. And I think the realm of historical possibility is open to us because we do not have an exhaustive account of what actually occurred. So anyway, I just want to confirm, though, that I appreciate and admire, and I do not want to sound like I'm, you know, dismissing all of the body of knowledge.
Oh, not
that
all. No one has.
Yeah, nobody feels that. I don't think that personal.
You seem like a really, really good guy. Really appreciate
it. And I don't want anybody leaving any negative comments for you either, because I think you
no,
you
I have
fourth
I,
position just, very very educated
just
wise.
Dr. Bowen, just to let you know, when I found out it was Dr. Bowen, I volunteered because I've watched you a couple of times, Dr. B, with Aaron Ra. I've spoken with Aaron Ra personally myself about Isaiah 53, and I know he did a video with you on that. And I came on because I wanted to kind of hear your perspective on stuff and to learn a perspective that I have not heard before. So that was part of the intent of why I volunteered. So thank you, Dr. B. for being patient.
And you want to be on with Tyler too, right? You volunteered because Tyler is on.
I'm nowhere near as cool as Dr. Bob is. But, you know, it would be great, Tyler, though. Daniel would be great to come on Digital Fiction. He would be actually a great guest to come on our show one day. He's, I think, a really smart guy, really interesting, really thoughtful. No, I totally appreciate Daniel. Yeah, people shouldn't really say any negative comments about it. We just have a disagreement opinion when it comes to scripture and how we interpret it. But, yeah, this was a great show.
Yeah, and you should have been more prepared. We could have like had all these sparks flying.
Yeah, it was the fun of with the dumpster fire. Oh man, you know, we're expecting so much here.
I can act like an idiot and do dumpster fire if you're looking for that too.
Well, let me get these super chats out of the way because I'm glad this wasn't a dumpster fire. I mean, they're fun every so often, but you can't have every.
Frog and toad in the wing. You want to do some serious theology? Right. I have frog and toad. So
okay,
I'm ready for a dumpster fire.
Well, maybe when you go on Digital Fiction, you can kick it up a notch. Let me read these off real quick. Wesley Skinner, $10. He doesn't know who Skyler is. Listen here, fellow audience members. After this show, y'all go need to sub to his channel and start listening to the things Christians will defend once Skyler corners them. Yeah, Skyler has really good discussions. Not gonna front. We're gonna revisit our discussion. We're gonna revisit his video on objective morality one of these days, but other than that, he's really good at what he does. Knockdown Wheel, five Canadian. Did you hear the one about the dyslexic insomniatic philosopher? He stayed up all night pondering the existence of dog. VRCNG TRX, $2. Here's my tithe to the Book of Agnosticism. Thank you. Bless you. Sarabia, $5. How is the gym competition having painful movements, soreness, and growth, if not a break, natural evil in contrast to stubbing a toe? Well, I mean, I don't think soreness would be a natural evil. That's actually, you know, beneficial. That tells you that your muscles are growing after you healing after you've worked out. I mean, stubbing a toe is just a gratuitous, you know, evil that happens. That's natural. It's not because of free will. So even the free will theodicy doesn't really have an accounting for that, right? It wasn't attended to. That wasn't Plantinga's. Now he does dive into it more when he brings a lot of things down to eventually reduce to Adam and Eve, but I think he jumps the shark at that point. So Plantinga's a very smart guy. No, I mean, I don't agree with him a lot of things, but he is clearly a brilliant philosopher. Brian Stevens, $2. The Skyler, he's got better kids. Checkmate atheist. Okay. Ram, well, SL, I gotta keep kids. SLI1, $5. The life of Brian was a far better story than anything in the Bible, and it made more sense. Life of Brian was a good movie. Sarah Bia, $5 more. At Skyler, it is logical for a God to create a world where he makes someone freely do something that's considered, quote, good behavior and still have choices. Or is it logical? He's asking you a question. Is it logical for God to create a world who makes someone freely do something that is considered good behavior and still have choices?
Well, you could, I could answer that question if they want. Well, I mean, the idea is basically, once again, that there are tons of things as human beings that we can't do. We don't have the choice to do. I can't regrow my arm if it gets cut off. I can't wings out of my back and fly. There are choices that I have am limited to in ability. Therefore, it seems very logical that God could put certain limitations on humans and we would still have all kinds of choices. And don't forget, the real choice, what we're really talking about when we talk about free will, is the idea that we have the ability to love God or not love him, to accept him or not accept him. That's the important part, right? That's what you'll hear the Christian argue. They'll argue that we would be robots and it would be like an abusive relationship if he forced us to love him. So when we talk about free will, we're not necessarily just talking about every little choice you make. We're talking about the ability to love God and accept him if you choose to.
Skyler, I have a quick thought on that, if you don't mind, or if we don't have time. I won't say.
Yeah. No,
okay,
go ahead.
For me, here's my position on the free will issue. And I think, Skyler, you've touched on the keystone of what it is. How do we approach God? Or does God approach us or whatever? One of my favorite examples of this free will, divine sovereignty issue is in The Lord of the Rings, where in the beginning, where Gandalf comes to Frodo in the Shire and sort of masterfully entices the little hobbit on to begin the journey to get rid of the ring. Now, Gandalf doesn't say, like, Frodo, you got to go do this. But the narrative that goes on there compels Frodo to go forward. And so by the time he gets to the Council of Elrond, what does he do? He volunteers to go on the quest to get rid of the ring under the watchful eye of Saruman. And I think that's a great way to do it, that Gandalf somehow, however he does it, persuades Frodo to start the journey. By the time he gets to Elrond and the council, he is volunteering for it. And so there's something in that God persuades us in some way that makes us, that does not, you know, violate our human creaturely volition. And I think Tolkien kind of masterfully explained how that all happened, I think, in The Lord of the Rings through a good story. That's my.
And let me add one thing. I think there might be a distinction made between what's called free choice and free will. As a compatibilist, which again, I don't think there's any really one perfect position when it comes to determinism and indeterminism.
No, it's a hard question.
It's a very hard question. And compatibilism is a lot of things that serve evils kind of thing. Because I don't believe in libertarian free will. I don't believe that we have free will, meaning that there are no external forces that influence. But I do believe we have will. But I know we have free choices. And there's a difference. Free choice is the ability to make a decision. Right. Let's say I decide to have wings on my back, as Skylar would say. I have the free will to do it. I don't have the action ability. And I think there's a distinction between the concept of making a free choice and enacting that free choice into free will. And I don't think that we have any. Whenever you do anything, there's always a reason behind it that's internal. And those internal things are still influenced somehow, some fundamental factors. The way they look at it is if you would rewind the tape and maybe make a decision and you say, okay, I have a choice between A and B, and I go back in time, given the exact same conditions, the incompatibilist would say, well, it's random. The other person could make A versus B. But the determinist would say, no, the person determined B has done B, will always do B given the exact same conditions, which is indicative to me that there are external forces that make our decisions in some way for us, right? So I think all in all, free will is more illusionary, but that this might my take on that. I think there's a made between having the choice to do something and having the free will to actually enact that free choice.
And I think it's interesting. Go ahead. I'll stop.
No, go ahead. Does that make sense to you, Daniel?
Yeah, I think there's some, I share some commonality with you in terms of the epistemic difficulty of trying to tease it out, but for me as a believer, because a lot of the problem with the free will defense of evil, if you will, if you carry that into eternity, the very good question is there free will in heaven?
Because and also predicated on libertarian free will.
No more death, crying, or whatever. Are our wills truly free? And so the answer to that question, and I know it won't be entirely satisfying intellectually or logically, but I think that
did we lose him?
Is found ultimately in Christ. And so that answers at least the eternal free will conundrum, that in Christ we are truly most free. But it does still leave a lot of perplexities down here. How do we approach? It still gets down to what Skylar said. How do we approach? What's human volition and divine sovereignty have to do with relationally speaking? How do we iron that out? But anyway, that's kind of where I leave it.
I agree.
But I share with you, Steve, a lot of the difficulties in epistemically in trying to go back to what are we exactly free from. In terms of making our wills, in terms, especially in terms of eternity, I know the traditional Calvinist position is that we can't do anything to save ourselves. But it's a long. It's not my favorite topic.
Well, maybe it's something good for you to go on Digital Fiction, because I know Skylar's pretty apt on this topic. So continue on, and CZ or V Towns, Tyre exists. It was never destroyed. Read. AC Castillo, $2. This reminds me of fans discussing Tolkien books. This reminds me of fans discussing Tolkien books, which, by the way, he does. AC Castillo just had a prediction that it came true. You are a prophet, my friend. You are. Here, $2 more. Who are the people that ended the Bronze Age in Jordan. We've talked about that before. I joked about that. I remember having a discussion on who the Sea People were. Or was that...
You're clipping a lot, Steve.
Yeah, your audio is bad.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just wrap this up then. Let me refresh.
Was he asking about the Sea Peoples?
Yeah, the Sea People.
Wasn't Phoenicia etymologically derivative of the color purple, Dr. B?
Okay. I mean, it's certainly the, what is it, the Murex shell?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a shell they crush and get purple. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the story, but I don't remember the get discussed at one time on Non Sequitur. But anyways, we do have to wrap this up. We've been going for almost 2.5 hours, so... go ahead and Daniel, give us your book again, and then we'll let Digital Hammurabi and or Digital Fiction in this case kind of wrap it up. And Wayne, if you're still here, appreciate you coming on too. I know you had mic issues, but hopefully you're in here listening because this was a great discussion. So Daniel, what do you got to leave us with?
I'm on Twitter right now. The only social we are working on building a website, but on Twitter it is the Story of the Cosmos with story underscore. Cosmos that you can look up, and I am actively engaged in civil discussions with people, anybody that wants to talk about the book. I got on it just to promote the book, I'm very excited. It's my first publication. I worked with a lot of really smart people. I'm the least qualified of the staff, but I'm one of the co-editors and co-contributors of The Story of the Cosmos, coming out on the day that Apollo 11 launched 50 years ago. Our book is coming out on the anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon launch and landing. So that's kind of nice. It'll be out July 16th of next year, or this year. It is this year awesome. Now. So yeah, Story of the Cosmos.
Okay, and Digital Fiction.
I'll go first, Skylar, so you can land hard. Yeah, I meant that stick in a good way.
Yeah, because Skylar, you're giving us you're giving us your sign off tonight. So when you give us your trademark sign off, Dave will end the feed. Go ahead.
Is this about bags?
No, I just want to sign off.
I really appreciated the discussion here with Daniel Edwin. Until we lost Wayne, it was really nice hearing from him. Yeah, and Skylar's going to talk at length, I guess, more about Digital Fiction. But as far as our own channels, you know, Skylar just hit 4,000 subs on his channel, which is fantastic. We are at 4,974 at Digital Hammurabi. So if you want to be number 5,000, get in while you can. And I would be remiss if I didn't talk about really quickly our scholarship program that we're running, PhD scholarship program. Megan, I think, will be very happy that I say this. We have, I think, now 9 applicants, and it looks like we may have raised enough money to give 3 $2,000 scholarships for a summer research program for PhD students. Awesome. So it's blowing up. So thank you all very much. Please go to digitalhammurabi.com. All the information is there for our Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all this stuff, and all the ways that you can contribute to the scholarship program. 100% of what you give goes to a PhD student. So
awesome. I just want to say it was amazing to be here tonight. You know, of course, I run the Skylar Fiction Show. And if you like stuff like this, if you like to hear me debate and have conversations with Christians, you would love my channel. I've had recently Mike Winger on my channel. I talked to Slimy Vocab Malone recently. all types of great, interesting people. Morality tends to be a big focus of mine. I love morality talks. We all know that I'm right. That's right, Steve. But the thing is, if you want entertainment, you want good theological discussions, if you want Bible talk, and you want to hear an atheist, when it comes to the Christian religion, at least, if you want to hear an atheist ask Christians tough questions and often sometimes see them not have good answers, I'm the channel you want to go check out. And Digital Fiction is kind of our new idea to where we're going to have a lot more fun. We're going to be a lot more creative. We're going to mix art, theology, philosophy, and entertainment all in one go around, right? I mean, with a sexy face like Dr. Josh and a brain that's even 10 times smaller than mine, how could you go wrong? So
just remember,
I appreciate all of you.
Thou shalt like and subscribe. So
that's true. And but if you want more,
people want to know real quick. Scott, if you real quick, are you doing an after show real quick?
Probably not. I've got to get some sleep. Probably not tonight, yeah. Man. I have been going every day, and I've got to be up at 6 a.m.
You
in the morning.
You've been going hard
every day. It's been going good, man. We're growing, man. I'll tell you what, like we had 150 people watching the last two nights. We had 200 people watching the night before live. So it's been like we've been getting incredible crowds for only having 4,000 subs. I want to make that difference. We need to get more people subscribed. I always tell people on my channel, the way we're going to keep getting better guests, higher names, is you guys got to watch. You got to share, and we got to get my name out there and Dr. Josh from Digital Hammurabi's name out there. Because, listen, we can be fun. We can have good debates. And the most important thing is I always say, you know, and I'll cut out in just a minute with my catchphrase here, is the idea that, like, if you want this world to be a better place, right, and you want to change things for the better, you've got to have good arguments. You've got to know if you think that religion is a dangerous thing, as I do, I think Christianity does things to people's minds and leads them down bad directions. Not in all cases. Let me be fair. Like, there are certain moderate Christian beliefs that can be very mellow. But people who, when you believe the Bible and you take it literal and you think that God did all these terrible things, in my opinion, it can lead you down very bad paths. And we've seen where history has happened. So you got to be prepared. You got to know the Bible. You got to have the good arguments. You need to know the tough questions to ask Christians. So you don't make terrible arguments as atheists. That's the worst thing you could do. You're not helping anybody. And you can do it with a smile and you can be friendly.
Yeah, those people can come to me. I'll help you with the bad atheist arguments. Come to my channel for that. I'll correct you on those. Me and Cyrus will fix you. All right, take us out, Skyler.
So, everybody, thank you for watching. We love you all. And until next time, subscribe and make the world a better place.
Good night.
Non sequitur, your facts are uncoordinated.